Thank you. Well, happy Eclipse Day, everybody. You know, there is no opportunity that is not going to be brazenly taken advantage of by a certain wing of the political spectrum with conspiracy theories and fear-mongering, and if they can, the blaming of someone on the left for sure. And we have an example of that with the eclipse. We are going to look not only at Rudy Giuliani, but also at video of Marjorie Taylor Greene's boyfriend, Brian Glenn, who is also an anchor. Excuse me, I almost choked on his name. On the right wing, Right Side Broadcasting Network. He is saying, look, you've got this rare eclipse. We had an earthquake in New York City. There's locusts, by which I guess he means the cicadas. I don't know. And it's all very suspicious and it could be sort of apocalyptic. And that's the context we have to understand this in. This is always a sort of overt or implicit alluding to apocalyptic, rapture, Christian type, fire and brimstone sort of stuff. And here is Brian Glenn from his car levying a warning. There is nothing they won't try to take advantage of and or end up being confused by.
I want you guys to have a fantastic weekend, and here's why. This might be the last normal weekend that we have for quite some time. I mean, we've got this solar eclipse on Monday, this very rare solar eclipse. Who knows what the fallout from that will be?
I don't think there's going to be any fallout.
Plus, that will be combined with several earthquakes. We've already seen a few already. And why not sprinkle in this infestation of locusts that have been dormant for years and all of a sudden will attack mankind? So why not? Oh, then throw in Joe Biden trying to get into a war with Iran for whatever reason he wants to do that. So on that note, have a great weekend. We'll see you next week or maybe not.
So I want you guys you have confusion about some things, right? Like earthquakes happen. Eclipses follow a predictable pattern. We knew about this one for a while. There are no locusts. What Brian Glenn seems to be referring to is that there are cicada broods, and there's a 13-year life cycle brood and a 17-year life cycle brood, and they're overlapping this year. This happens every such number of years. And it always has to sort of push to, can we blame the left for anything? So he throws in a Biden geopolitical thing. And also, can we make some kind of reference to Bible scripture? And in this case, it's about locusts, because locusts are one of the plagues. Cicadas are not. But if you don't know the difference between locusts and cicadas, maybe it makes for some good fear mongering. And then as a bonus clip here, here is Rudy Giuliani also jumping in on this, saying that the earthquakes are God sending a message. It can't ever just be a probabilistic phenomenon where sometimes there are earthquakes and sometimes there are eclipses. It always has to be something. And here it is, a punishment from God for the communism of New York and California. Now, you might say, well, but California wasn't affected by this earthquake. No, but sometimes California does have earthquakes. So that's Rudy. Take a listen to this.
We left the communist state of New York. And then we were in the state of Connecticut, and we just escaped all of the earthquakes. And then we got to Massachusetts, which probably had some earthquakes. And we got to New Hampshire with no earthquakes, which is telling me that somebody's sending us a message.
Right.
Communist states are getting earthquakes. I think that's what look at California. You can't have more earthquakes than California.
Right. Famously, communistic California, which is the tech center, arguably, of the world. Famously communistic Massachusetts, which is a biotech hub for big pharma profits the world over. Famous communism. Famously communistic Connecticut, filled with better tax circumstances for the wealthy New York business elite who choose to go to Connecticut rather than New York to save money on taxes. All famous elements and pinnacles and centers of communism. So it's what are the takeaways here? Obviously, Brian Glenn and Rudy Giuliani are not necessarily the people we want to be listening to. But it's this reminder that when everything when you have only hammers, everything looks like a nail. Biden foreign policy, bad, related to the politics that are evil. Earthquakes, same thing. Locusts, which are actually cicadas, God's wrath because of bad stuff that liberals are doing. Everything's a conspiracy. Everything is a punishment for leftism. And sometimes it's not even real leftism. It's simply perceived leftism, which is important. And in my forthcoming book, there's not a chapter on locusts. I can tell you that's not something you have to worry about. There isn't a chapter about earthquakes, and there is not a chapter about eclipses. But there is a chapter about when you abandon critical thinking and deep policy, what you end up with is stuff like this, where all you have is, well, you can tell God's angry because of what leftists are doing, or you can tell that we are doing something wrong because of the punishments that are being sent. And it really abstracts you from any serious thinking. So the bad news is this is all they have left. The good news is a bunch of the numbers for President Joe Biden continue to improve. I would argue it's because Republicans are not offering nothing but the nonsense we just saw. Let's talk about the polling next. There is a stunning new poll out of the critical battleground state of Pennsylvania, and it has Joe Biden ahead by 10 over former President Donald Trump in a head-to-head race. Biden up by 2 in a multi-way race. So we're going to look at this, and then we'll look at where the national polls are going. And later in the week, we'll have a little bit of follow up to my recent conversation with Rachel Bitticoffer. So let's start at the very beginning, as I like to do. New poll from Franklin and Marshall. In a multi-way race, Biden, Trump, Kennedy, and Jill Stein, you see that it is Biden plus 2, with Trump at 40, Kennedy at 9, and Jill Stein at 3. When you do the same polling with a group of registered voters as only Biden versus Trump, it is Biden plus 10. Two important takeaways here. Takeaway number one, Biden's numbers do seem to be improving, at least in some of these critical battleground states. And takeaway number two, it continues to appear that the third party candidates are hurting Joe Biden. When you inject, like bleach, when you inject third party candidates into Pennsylvania, Biden's lead goes from 10 all the way down to only 2. So some evidence there that the third party candidates are bad for Joe Biden. But overall, it's good news that after a bunch of months during which Pennsylvania was looking only like Trump was ahead, we finally have it's only one poll. But the point is, we look at an average. If it starts to shift, that's a good sign. We have one new poll that the most recent poll, which shows a shift away from Trump and towards Joe Biden in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is only one of many critical states, and we will be looking at what the polling is looking like in other critical states. But that's not the only good news. If you are President Joe Biden, the fundraising numbers are, of course, very good news. But the national numbers are also good news. Looking now at national numbers, what 2 months ago was almost exclusively national polls led by the failed former president Donald Trump, it's now about 50-50. You see that Trump's leads have gotten smaller, like the size of his hands. In the Emerson College poll, Trump is leading by only 1. They are tied in the YouGov poll. In the very much right-leaning Trafalgar poll, Trump's only winning by 3 there. And then you've got a bunch of polls in which Joe Biden is now leading. The Morning Consult poll has it Biden plus 2. Big Village has it Biden plus 1 or 2, depending on who you include. You've got Data for Progress polls that in a multi-way race, it's Trump plus 1. But in head-to-head, it's Biden plus 1. Marist College has a new poll in which Biden is leading. So the point here is we don't look at just one poll, but the tide has shifted to some degree, where we had almost exclusively polls led by Donald Trump 2 months ago, 6 weeks ago. We now have it about 50-50. Trump's leads have experienced shrinkage down to about 1 or 2 in most cases, and Joe Biden now has a number of leads. Now, if we go back to what Rachel Bitticoffer said to me last week, she said it's still too early to really pay attention to the polls. Now, that's her perspective. She is certainly more of an expert than I am on the issue of polling. I did look historically, and it tends to be the case that polling in April of an election year already more or less reflects what we see in November. Rachel Bitticoffer's argument is that while that may have been the case in times past, we have such unique circumstances this time around. We have criminal trials. We have all sorts of different things that have not yet fleshed out the circumstances that will present themselves in November, that the numbers could still change. In either case, what we are pointing towards is a relatively close election, likely to be determined by under half a million votes in five or six states, and a situation in which none of us should say, I don't think I need to participate in this one. All of us need to be realizing we do need to participate. The polling is improving for Joe Biden, but the polling is a reflection, hopefully, of our intent. And so it would be wrong to see polling improving and say, I don't need to participate. We just say, oh, polling is improving because people like me plan to participate and plan to go out there and vote for Joe Biden. So that's where we are right now. We did get another very solid jobs report. It absolutely devastated Fox News. We're going to talk about that after the break. And please remember the third children's book. Wow. Think Like a Voter. Written by me. I did everything right. OK. Written by me is available at davidpakman.com/book. It's a trilogy. Get all three. Get just one. Get two. I guess those are the possible combinations. And make sure to leave a review. That's the critical thing. We've already sold, I think, 1,000 of these things, and there's only 53 reviews. That's not good. Not good. So leave a review, davidpakman.com/book. Let's take a break. We're going to do a look at the jobs numbers. We are going to do a deep dive on a recent religious debate that was sent to me. We've got some interesting stuff on today's show. We may actually record and keep evidence of today's show, unlike some others, which we immediately delete. The David Pakman Show is a community-supported program. If you listen to the podcast or watch on YouTube, listen on the radio, watch some of our TikToks, it's all primarily funded by members who sign up at joinpakman.com. Part of what sets apart shows that succeed and shows that don't is that the shows that succeed have some kind of insurance policy against when YouTube drops the hammer and cuts off all your revenue, as has happened to us before. When Facebook drops the hammer and cuts off all of your revenue, which has happened many times before. Or when TikTok kicks you out of the creator program, which has happened to us before. The insurance is folks who sign up on our website and are not algorithmically involved in supporting us. It is direct support. We give great perks and benefits to those who support us on the website, including a daily bonus show, commercial-free audio and video streams of the show, and so many other great things. So listen, my view, and it's a biased view, is that membership is a great thing to consider, and it's very inexpensive. The new website goes live this Sunday. When it does, membership prices will go up, but you can lock in today's rates, which have been the same rates for a decade, quite frankly. You can lock in today's rates for as long as you want to keep them by signing up at joinpakman.com. And the coupon code SAVEDEMOCRACY24 will also save you, I think it's about 50%. Fox News hosts devastated by another great jobs report. It's not good for them because they don't want Joe Biden to win. They want to justify the return and resurrection of Donald Trump. And if the economy's going pretty well, it becomes harder to argue that Joe Biden should lose his job and Trump should be put back in. So let's take a look at this. This is really wild to watch. They can't avoid some obvious truths, like that the economy is doing better than expected. And yet, there's a lot here. So let's start with the report of the March jobs report delivered on Friday, and then we'll go from there.
March jobs report is crossing the tape right now. Lauren Simonetti with the breaking news. Lauren.
Stronger than expected. Headline number for March, 303,000 jobs added in the month of March. The expectation was 200,000. Revisions, February revised down by 5,000 to 270,000. Unemployment rate unexpectedly drops from 3.9%, which was a two-year high, to 3.8%. Immediate reaction in the market. Maria, I am seeing futures moving a little bit higher.
Right.
And That's all I'm getting at the moment. I'm trying to get my rates. But they're stronger than expected. At the surface report, I'll continue to dive in to get you some of the wages and the other stuff, Maria.
Yeah, well, look, we're looking at a market that is up, but off of the highs, okay? We're losing steam, and we're losing steam fast. The March job.
Everything's good, but not accelerating as quickly as it once was. So the market is still up, but it's not going up as quickly as it once was. This is what they have. We are seeing a deceleration in the continued improvement of a great economy.
Report out, and it is better than expected, hotter than expected. 303,000, Lauren just told us. Dan Niles, give us your reaction to this report as the market loses its rally. It is now up 20 points and going lower.
Well, you got to remember, some of this was discounted yesterday, Maria, and that the market sold off pretty hard.
All right, so you get the point. Sure, it's all good, but it's not as explosively good as it once was, and thus things continue to improve, but at a slightly slower rate. You're digging pretty deep here. Now, then they go into, this is my favorite when Fox News does this. It's one of the, is the economy too good for its own good moments, suggesting, listen, these are good numbers, but are these numbers so good that it will delay the Federal Reserve from cutting rates, which is apparently really what Fox News wants? The number may be too good.
Here with you, your reaction to this jobs report.
Very good, Maria. The household employment was actually up almost 500,000. The unemployment rate fell. The work week was stable. It looks really good right now. Certainly better than consensus expectations. Better than a lot of other data might suggest. The PMIs, for example, purchasing manager surveys suggest there should be weakening employment. So at least for March, things look good. Even if we look at the private sector, your job growth over 200,000. If I take out healthcare, still looking at private ex healthcare of around 150. It's a good number, no question.
Well, it's a good number, but is it too good for rate cuts, Bob Dahl? I mean, yesterday we heard from Neil Kashkari saying...
You're hearing this correctly. Fine. 303,000 people found jobs. It's good, but is it too good for rate cuts? Because part of the whole evaluation of the Fed is if the jobs market continues being good, they might not cut rates, or maybe they will, or maybe they will, but it could just be too good for what it is that we want. Is the economy, is the job market too good? Not a question you hear asked when there's a Republican in the White House by Fox News, that's for sure. Here's another classic from Fox News. I love this. Here they say, well, fine, there's a bunch of new jobs and it's all very good, but a lot of these jobs are government jobs, and we're Republicans, and we don't want the government providing employment. We want smaller government, not bigger government. And Maria likes that. Maria likes it when they can find some way to denigrate a good jobs report when you have a Democrat in the White House, because these are the most blindly partisan actors you can imagine.
What strikes you most, Joe Livonia? What do you want to say about the nuts and bolts of this report?
Yeah. The health care is important because that's tied into government spending, and government jobs have been very, very robust, Maria. So the question is, why is the economy outperformed expectations? And one of the reasons is we have had significant government spending. So, for example, if you look at the spending data from the Treasury. Pre-COVID, we were running at about a 5 to 6% annual rate, which is still very fast. Since January of 2021, I've calculated we've had effectively about $3.25 trillion of excess spending. In other words, spending...
There you go. So let me interpret this for those who might be saying, David, isn't this a good jobs report? Yes, you're right. They are digging deep here, and Maria likes it. She goes, when it's presented to her. Sure, jobs are looking good. And if you look and you see, wow, healthcare jobs are up, but a lot of healthcare jobs are a result of government spending, and government spending we don't like. Government spending is bad. Now, of course, this is such a myopic and limited view. We've talked before about how different sorts of government spending have varied economic multiplier effects. There is very useful and stimulative economic government spending, rather. And there is government spending that's not so economically stimulative. For example, tax cuts for the very rich who don't need any more money to fund their lifestyles get socked away in the bank with a relatively low economic multiplier. Food stamps, on the total other side of the spectrum, are very economically stimulative because all of that money is likely to be spent. It's injected back into local economies. It trickles down in a way through different industries. So the point here is they are against this jobs report being good, because even though it looks good, there's a lot of healthcare jobs funded by government spending, and that's not so good. Maria likes that one. That's a good one. She says, that's a good way to try to attack this report. And then lastly here, there is the idea, which is a classic now, maybe the reason employers are hiring is they expect Trump to win in November and improve the economy. And this is straight out of Trump's mouth. Trump now unable to argue that the stock market isn't doing well. So Trump has started to say the only reason the stock market's doing well is because I'm winning in the polls, and because people, the economy benefits from me being president. They think I will be president. And so that's why the stock market's doing well. There's no evidence of this whatsoever. Maria Bartiromo applies it to employers hiring.
The Trump is in the lead, I think, in four of the five key battleground states.
Six out of seven.
I just wonder if maybe the market is pricing in a little bit, and employers too, the idea that maybe we're going to get a new president in November.
We'll see. Does that work into your looking at markets, the idea that we could see policy changes next year? What do you think, Bob Dahl?
So, again, the idea, and by the way, it's kind of a dumb idea. If you just think about it at its core, most businesses are not in such a long hiring cycle where they would, even though the, because think about what they're saying, right? Things aren't getting better now. They expect things will be better in January when Trump is inaugurated, or maybe by the time, because Trump has to put in place his policies, maybe by February of 2025, maybe by March of 2025, because employers think once Trump wins in November, is inaugurated in January, puts in place some policies, and those policies have time to work. By the way, what are the policies? They never say. By March or April of next year, thanks to Trump, things will be better. So I'm just going to start hiring people now. Seems like a very stupid business decision. Why on earth would you start hiring people now and incurring payroll costs for an economy that you expect to be better thanks to Trump a year from now? It would be extraordinarily dumb. By the way, it's sort of like, as I've said, even though I support Biden and I believe Biden is better for the country, I've said, when people like Trump win, it's better for progressive shows. Shows like mine grow much faster when there's a lunatic right winger in the White House. So if Trump wins, I would expect that the show will grow. Might I want to hire an additional person if that were to happen to produce more content and distribute it? Sure. But I would wait until that happens. I would wait at least until November, if not January. I wouldn't start hiring people in April, because I expect the show to benefit from Trump being president, especially since the polling is very mixed. So this is another act of desperation from those on Fox who just want to argue it's all bad, except when it's good, it's probably because of expectations around Donald Trump. And they didn't stop here. They also complained about the jobs report with regard to immigrants. And I want to talk about that separately. So let's go to that next. After yet another very solid jobs report, 303,000 new jobs created in March, Republican Senator J.D. Vance appeared with Fox brown noser Maria Bartiromo, and he's essentially complaining that some of the jobs are going to immigrants. By the way, a lot of these immigrants have been in the country for decades. Like, just the fact that they're immigrants doesn't really mean anything functionally. But of course, he wants to tie it to undocumented immigration, to border policy, to Joe Biden. And this is a really crystal clear example, J.D. Vance and Maria Bartiromo finding a way to downplay a really good jobs report by saying some of the jobs recently, especially under Biden, have gone to immigrants. So you do two things. You downplay the state of the economy and you again dive into this migrants are bad perspective. Sure, the economic numbers might look good, but it's migrants that are benefiting. Take a listen to this.
Biden wants to flag wave about how well the economy is doing. You know, I've been home for the last 2 weeks, Maria. People just don't buy it. People recognize that it's getting harder to live your dreams under the Biden economy. And it's unfortunately because a lot of that net job growth has gone to the foreign war. What a disgraceful commentary for the president to be bragging about an economy that's benefiting illegal immigrants more than American citizens.
That is just astounding, Senator. And
it's also completely ridiculous, untrue, and misleading. There's no talking point that is just too far for Maria Bartiromo. That is, you know, that she's known for James Comer appearing and saying, we're starting to look at whether Joe Biden may be running some kind of murder for hire ring. Stunning, Senator. Stunning, Congressman. I can't believe it. You tell Maria Bartiromo anything she wants to hear, and she goes, that's just unbelievable. It's, of course, completely ridiculous. In one breath, J.D. Vance says, a lot of these jobs are going to the foreign-born, and illegal immigrants are benefiting more than natural-born Americans. There's absolutely no connection between any of those things. Yes, there are some foreign-born people who have gotten jobs. That's true. Many of them have been here for decades. Many of them are American citizens. And by the way, the very same people that say nobody wants to work anymore are complaining that there are people working the jobs that are offered and taking jobs. That's one of the incredible inconsistent myths that's repeated about immigrants, both legal and undocumented, which is these are some of the laziest people in the world coming to the United States to collect welfare benefits. And they're taking all our jobs and mostly the ones that are benefiting from the hot job market. Wait a second. So are they lazy and sitting at home collecting welfare benefits, or are they working so much that they're taking the jobs of natural born citizens? Can you tell me which it is? To them, it's, of course, both. The reality, of course, is that the jobs are going to a variety of folks. Just because you're foreign born doesn't mean that you're a recent immigrant, doesn't mean you're an undocumented immigrant. There's just foreign born people in the United States. In fact, I'm foreign born. If I were to go and get one of these jobs, even though I've been here since I was five, I guess I would show up in the category of foreign born. But what does it really mean? All my schooling has been in the United States. I've paid taxes here for decades. I mean, it doesn't really mean anything. So they definitely don't want them collecting welfare benefits and taking our tax money. And it seems like they also don't want them working. So it's just another one of these desperate talking points because they know that they have nothing else. Let's take a very quick break. Make sure you're subscribed on YouTube, youtube.com/TheDavidPackman Show. And then the show continues. All right. Over the weekend, someone sent me a link to an interview that Christian apologist William Lane Craig did with Alex O'Connor. Now, I'll tell you up front, this is not a new interview, but someone sent it to me and said, you know, David, what would be interesting to see you do in some of these interviews is take one specific claim that's made by someone and just look at that one claim and whether what they cite as the premises for their beliefs are even true. So let's do it. And you tell me whether this is interesting. What you're going to see here is that William Lane Craig is asked about the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus on Easter. What evidence do we have that Jesus was dead and then came back to life? Alex O'Connor asks William Lane Craig. Let's listen to what William Lane Craig says, and then we're going to pick one of these claims and examine it a little more closely.
I think my listeners will be broadly familiar, so perhaps without going into too much depth, just bullet pointing, what are the main points of evidence that you would direct people's attention to say these are reasons to think that a man rose from the dead on Easter morning?
First, I would say, what are the facts to be explained? And those would include things like the death of Jesus of Nazareth by Roman crucifixion during Passover around AD 30. Second, his burial or interment in a tomb by a member of the Sanhedrin, the Jewish Sanhedrin named Joseph of Arimathea. Thirdly, the discovery by a group of his female followers on the Sunday morning after the crucifixion that that tomb was empty. Fourth would be that thereafter various individuals and groups of people experienced appearances of Jesus alive after his death.
Okay, so he's going on and listing the so-called evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. So let's just take one of those things. One of the things that William Lane Craig mentions is the tomb in which Jesus had been buried after the initial crucifixion he mentions. The tomb was empty. There was Jesus was in there, and then all of a sudden, Jesus was no longer in the tomb. And this is a central element of Christian apologia, of apologetics, which is he was in the tomb and then he was gone. Now, is there any evidence of that? He says there's evidence that he was in the tomb and then he wasn't. The first important point is, even if it were true that individuals came to believe at the time that where Jesus had been interred, he was gone, that alone doesn't prove anything. The fact that some might claim that. But my question when I hear such a claim is there any real historical evidence outside of sacred texts? I get that for a lot of this stuff, you can go to sacred text and find scripture that makes these claims. But is there anything outside of it? Well, you look, what are the primary sources for the supposedly empty tomb of Jesus? It's the New Testament Gospels. It's Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They describe an empty tomb was found by women followers of Jesus on the first day of the week after his crucifixion. Those are religious texts. They are sacred texts. This is sort of like, you know, looking at marketing documents and saying, what's the proof that that this drug works? Well, it's the marketing documents from the makers of the drug. A lot of us would say, well, do we have any randomized controlled trials, for example, that we might look at instead? So you can look at sacred texts and say, is there any overlap with independently known historical information about the life of Jesus, the historicity of Jesus that could overlap with some of this? But there is very little. When you look for corroboration from non-biblical sources for the empty tomb of Jesus, you have, I mean, to call it limited evidence is probably even being favorable. Now, historians and scholars do debate, is there anything that we can find outside of scripture to verify the empty tomb? And there really isn't much. You look at Jewish and Roman sources, none of them mention in any direct way the empty tomb. You find some Christian scholars who say there are some implications, there are indirect references. You can look at the Jewish historian Josephus, who mentions Jesus and his following and references the fact that some claimed within other venues about the empty tomb, but it's extraordinarily shaky, and most of it has been after the fact claimed to be indicative of the empty tomb, even though historians don't agree about that. You can look at Tacitus and other Roman historians who mention the execution of Jesus by Pontius Pilate written around 116 A.D., but it doesn't mention the resurrection. It doesn't mention the empty tomb. So you certainly don't have any kind of independent corroboration there. If you say, is there any Christian writing outside of the New Testament that talks about it, like from the church fathers discuss the resurrection broadly. They mention the empty tomb. But those are not non-biblical historical texts. They're just Christian traditional texts that work off of the New Testament content. And then you say, well, is there archaeological evidence of the empty tomb believed to belong to Jesus? And the answer is no. There is no archaeological evidence there that has been accepted by archaeologists. There have been sites proposed to be, this is the place. There are sites revered to be the location of the tomb, but there's been no historical confirmation. So, you know, when we look at these broad claims, there are really articulate apologists like William Lane Craig who just mention the evidence in passing and say, predicated on all that was my belief in the resurrection of Jesus, which is totally a legitimate and substantiated belief. If you take one piece, the empty tomb, it's a foundational belief in the Christian resurrection of Jesus, but you can't corroborate it in any real way from non-biblical sources. And we have to be super careful where they in a very long list of things cite this stuff. Now, we could do this with every one of the other claims that he makes for the resurrection of Jesus. But just as far as the empty tomb, when you examine it, I'm not able to find anything that surpasses any level of scrutiny. Now, what you often get as a counterpoint from apologists is, well, a lot of this stuff goes beyond archaeological and empirical evidence. Well, then we're already operating in an area where it doesn't really matter where we can prove it. You're saying it may be so special, unique, and supernatural in nature that you will never find such proof. Well, but then don't cite that you have the proof until we point out that's just from the Gospels. But that's often part of that shifting sort of moving goalpost of what evidence we would expect to find. And then when we say, well, actually, we don't have that, they go, well, it doesn't matter. It's supernatural. It's beyond belief. It requires faith. Is this interesting at all? Let me know. Can certainly do more of it or can choose never to go back to it again. But this was one that came up, I guess, because it recently was Easter, right? I think. And this interview was 1 year ago. Let me know what you think. I want to do a little bit of a then and now for you here. Many of you have written in and said, David, I've been looking at old videos of the failed former president, Donald Trump. And it's very much true what your mental health and cognitive health experts have said. It was a completely different Trump. It was a Trump whose vocabulary was so much richer. It was a Trump whose rapidity was so much more noticeable. So let's do a little then and now. This is one of Donald Trump's first major television interviews in 1980. He was asked, do you want to be president? And you will see that he's articulate, he is charismatic, and his vocabulary is far richer than it is today. Let's start here.
Just for 10 minutes.
For some people, the ultimate goal in life has been becoming the president of the United States. Would you like to be the president of the United States?
I really don't believe I would, Rona, but I would like to see somebody as the president who could do the job. And there are very capable people in this country.
Most people who are capable are not running for office. Most men are frightened of politics today.
It is a shame, isn't it?
Yes.
It is a shame. The most capable people are not necessarily running for political office. And that is a very sad commentary on the country. They had major corporations and they had this and that, but they are not running for political office.
Why wouldn't someone like yourself run for political office? You have all the money that you possibly need. You've accomplished a great deal, even though you are only 34. I know there's a lot of things that you possibly can do in the years ahead. Why wouldn't you dedicate yourself to public service?
Because I think it's a very mean life. I would love and I would dedicate my life to this country, but I see it as being a mean life.
All right. So very articulate, quick thinking, coherent in every way. Now, you might say, David, it's so unfair to compare 2024 Trump to 34-year-old Trump from 44 years ago. But even in 2015, Trump was very, very much more with it. And also in 1992. Let's start with 92. Here's Trump on Letterman in 1992, and it is nothing like what you see today.
Are you solvent?
Well, I've had a hell of a year. I've had a good year. I had a miserable year last year, along with everybody else in the real estate industry. But this year has been, as you know, sort of from reading the New York press, a good year for me. And the politicians killed the real estate industry, and we've done great.
Now, see, I don't know what that means when you say the politicians killed the real estate industry.
Well, in 1986, they passed a tax change, the 1986 law. Which really, you look at what happened with Olympia in New York and Reichman and everybody else, and it's big trouble.
They lost incentives. Real estate no longer became a good place to put your dough.
Exactly, and it's coming back strong now. And we've worked hard over the last 6 months, and I think we have really done a job.
So stunning, really. I mean, this is not a Donald Trump that we have seen, certainly for several years. And then in 2015, also, Trump asked in a different interview, what is it you want people to know about you? and it is just a completely different guy.
What's one thing that you would like people to know about you that they don't, especially those who are dismissive of your campaign?
Well, I think the one thing is I'm a nice person. I love helping people. I have great relationships with people. People think of me as not necessarily nice, but they think of me as very competent. You know, it was very interesting. A woman heard a speech, and I got a very high poll number. But on leadership, I was by far the highest, by many times. On finance and economics and the economy, I was number one by many, many times. I was killing everybody.
But
except,
what about niceness?
Except on niceness, I was like last. And I said to the people, it was crazy, a CNN poll. And I said to the people, I said, you know, sort of interesting. Number one, I think I am a nice person. I help people. And a woman came up to me. She said, but are you nice enough to be president? I said, I hope I am. I think I'm a nice person.
All right. So you get the point. Trump speaking with a facility, engaging with the interviewers in a way that is much more tuned into what's going on around him, able to sort of read the real meaning of these questions and addressing it. And then all of a sudden now we are left with this.
I heard that Saudi Arabia and Russia will repeat.
Trump not only relying on a teleprompter, even with the prompter, often unable to speak. Trump confusing Nikki Haley and Nancy Pelosi, as many of you know. And as Dr. Harry Siegel and Dr. John Gartner pointed out, he doesn't realize he's done it. He doesn't correct himself and just keeps on going.
You know, by the way, they never report the crowd on January 6th. You know, Nikki Haley, you know, they destroyed all of the information, all of the evidence, everything, deleted and destroyed all of it because of lots of things like Nikki Haley is in charge of security. We offered her 10,000 people, soldiers, National Guard, so whatever they want. They turned it down. They don't want to talk about that.
An extraordinarily confused Trump is now the norm. And of course, many times confusing Joe Biden and Barack Obama on the campaign trail.
Putin, you know, has so little respect for Obama that he's starting to throw around the nuclear word today. You heard that, nuclear. He's starting to talk nuclear weapons today. I was waiting for that to happen.
And of course, Putin is probably not thinking very much about Obama since Obama's not the president of the United States. This is happening all the time. Trump genuinely confused about what's going on, saying that it was Barack Obama that was defeated by Joe Biden.
Say it against Biden, in the largest margins ever. You know, what was interesting. Joe Biden won against Barack Hussein Obama. Has anyone ever heard of him?
And of course, the crowd realizing, oh, my goodness, he's doing it again. Trump regularly insisting you need ID to buy bread, even though this is, of course, not the case.
They're bad at policy. They have no idea what they're doing. They have open borders. They have no voter ID. They don't want voter ID. I saw on the television one of these characters. There shouldn't be voter ID. Now, you have voter ID to buy a loaf of bread. You have ID to buy a loaf of bread. You have.
And of course, you don't. But Trump keeps insisting that you do, getting confused about when do you need ID. Many times Trump confusing the terrorist group Hamas with the delicious chickpea spread hummus.
Heard about today, the Hamas terrorist invasion. I mean, when you think about, and what do you think of Hamas? What do you think? Do you know about Hamas?
Right. Hummus, Hamas, Baba Ghanoush, it's all very confusing. And of course, Donald Trump with just endless, endless examples of this, talking about communists and markers rather than what he wants to say, which is Marxists. And this is another example of Trump's phonemic paraphrasias. Very detailed explanation of those in my interview with Dr. John Gartner.
I will also order our government to deny entry to all communists and markers. Look, we have Marxists, fascists, communists, they're pouring into our country.
So listen, it's obviously a very different Trump. It's obviously a very different Biden. But so far, all of the experts we've spoken to, and this comes up in my forthcoming appearance on the Iced Coffee Hour, all of the experts we've spoken to say with Biden, you see reasonable and expected age related slowing down. With Trump, you see really concerning signs. And the contrast is extraordinary. Let me know your thoughts on this. Is the then and now comparison useful? Let me know what you think. Failed former President Donald Trump is in big trouble when it comes to the issue of abortion. He is trying to please everyone and may end up pleasing no one, putting out a confused and very odd statement this morning about the issue of abortion after sort of issuing a warning last night that he would be putting out such a statement. Trump publishing to his platform Truth Social last night, quote, "I will be putting out my statement on abortion and abortion rights tomorrow morning. Republicans and all others must follow their hearts and minds. But remember that, like Ronald Reagan before me, I and most other Republicans believe in exceptions for rape, incest and life of the mother. Great love and compassion must be shown when even thinking about the subject of life. But at the same time, we must use common sense in realizing that we have an obligation to the salvation of our nation, which is currently in serious decline, to win elections, without which we will have nothing other than failure, death and destruction. We will not let that happen. We will make America great again." So it sounds here like he's warning his followers. Listen, pro-life, all of that great stuff. But you've got to win elections. And in order to win elections, we need to have some exceptions because the exceptions are popular and well-liked by most Americans. So that gets us to this morning. And Trump launches into proudly being responsible for ending Roe v. Wade.
"Especially since I was proudly the person responsible for the ending of something that all legal scholars, both sides, wanted and in fact demanded be ended. Roe v. Wade. They wanted it ended."
So he here is making sure that everybody remembers. Everybody wanted to end Roe v. Wade. Not true, by the way. In fact, most of the country didn't want to end Roe v. Wade. There were some people who claimed to be pro-choice but believe Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided. It's a very small portion of Americans. And immediately when Roe v. Wade was overturned and undone by the Supreme Court, based on the three justices Trump selected, the country revolted and voted for abortion rights in every referendum that has been held since. But then Trump gets into the real meat of this. The real meat of this is what? The real meat of this is, listen, states want to ban it. States want to legalize it. States want to make exceptions, take away exceptions. It's all fine with me as long as you vote for me and don't blame me for anything that you don't like when it comes to abortion. This is called the rubber meeting the road. As long as you vote for Trump, do whatever the hell you want. Here's Trump explaining that in slightly different language.
"My view is now that we have abortion where everybody wanted it from a legal standpoint, the states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both. And whatever they decide must be the law of the land. In this case, the law of the state. Many states will be different. Many will have a different number of weeks, or some will have more conservative than others, and that's what they will be. At the end of the day, this is all about the will of the people."
Now, Trump's trying to appeal to everybody. This is sort of like when Trump took every position on an issue. And it's like, just pick the one you like. That's the one, you know, we'll go with it. Well, but some of these conflict. Just pick the one you want. Trump is essentially confirming that he doesn't really have a core position on this. And to be honest, I believe Trump is obviously pro-choice. He's been pro-choice his entire life. We'll play a clip of that in a moment. But the pro-lifers, the hardcore pro-lifers are going to say, "But sir, if abortion is murder the way we believe and we thought you believed too, how are you okay letting some states decide to legalize it? This can't be. This can't be." Now, this may still work because a lot of Trump's voters are just sort of like, he once said something I agree with. But remember this interview. This is 7 years before Trump. This is from 1999. So this is years before Trump became against abortion, pro-life. Here he is with his real opinion. And I'll be honest, I believe this is still Trump's real opinion on abortion.
"Eliminating of abortion in the third trimester, big issue in Washington. Would President Trump ban partial birth abortion?"
"Well, look, I'm very pro-choice. I hate the concept of abortion. I hate it. I hate everything it stands for. I cringe when I listen to people debating the subject. But I just believe in choice. And again, it may be a little bit of a New York background because there is some different attitude in different parts of the country. And, you know, I was raised in New York and grew up and work and everything else in New York City. But I am strongly for choice, and yet I hate the concept of abortion."
"But you would not ban it?"
No.
Or ban partial birth abortion?
No, I would. I am pro-choice in every respect.
He wouldn't even ban so-called partial birth abortion, which is a term that was much more common in 1999 when this was recorded. Now, different terms are used, including late-term abortion, all of which are extraordinarily rare and almost always extenuating circumstances. So choice, that, right? Trump's, this is the pro-choice perspective. This is the real freedom perspective. I might personally be against it. I might cringe at the thought of an abortion, but I am completely and totally pro-choice. Now, we know that Trump's story of how he became anti-abortion is a total lie. When Trump decided to run for president, I think he was in his late 60s, pro-choice his whole life. In his late 60s, Trump said, you know, I used to be pro-choice because I was raised in New York and so on, but I once met a kid and it was a nice kid. And the kid's mom said, I thought about having an abortion and then I didn't. And look at how great this kid is. And Trump wants us to believe that's why he changed his mind. So Trump is trying to thread the needle here. He's saying, listen, now it's just back to the states. States will do what they're going to do. It's all fine. And what Trump means is don't stay home or don't vote for Biden over my position on abortion. Everything's fine. Pick whatever you want. Do conservative, do liberal, whatever you want to do. Just make sure that you vote for me, which is classic Trump. Melania Trump reappeared at Trump's big dollar fundraiser in Florida over the weekend, looking absolutely miserable, miserable, looking like she is being held hostage. You have to see this. As a reminder, Joe Biden was criticized because he raised $25 million at an event. Oh, he has the elites. He has the rich people, whatever. Then Trump goes and holds his own fundraiser, at which he claims to have raised $50 million. Now, just because Trump claims to have raised $50 million at one event, I don't necessarily believe it because Trump lies all the time. But here is Melania. Look, I was checking to see whether she was blinking Morse code for hostage during this video. She does not look pleased to be back and involved. Looks almost like she's dying of misery. Take a look at this short clip outside Trump's big fundraiser.
Just wanting change. The rich people want it. Poor people want it. Everybody wants change. Our country is really doing poorly. We're a laughing stock all over the world. We're going to get that change very quickly. And this has been some incredible evening before. Just
so, yeah, the suspicions that Melania has been conspicuously missing from the campaign trail for very specific reasons. She doesn't want to be there. It seemed to be borne out by her presence here. And as far as the fundraiser goes, I just want to remind everybody, when Biden hit this single day fundraising record, it was supposedly bad because he had the support of the elites. When Trump supposedly hits a record, it's good because it means people want to contribute to MAGA and people see their future of the country in supporting Trump and whatever. Now, I am not a defender of this entire system, but if by people you mean billionaires, right? I mean, Trump's sold out fundraiser reportedly had 100 people there with tickets ranging from $250,000 to $750,000, $800 million if you wanted to sit at Trump's table. And of the $50 million that supposedly was raised, almost $10 million came from just 10 people, including folks like disgraced former Republican Senator Kelly Loeffler, the disgraced casino mogul Steve Wynn, the Mercers, Robert and Rebecca Mercer. Now, Biden, the whole system's corrupt. OK, at least Biden had 5,000 people to raise 25 million rather than 100 to supposedly raise 50 million. And you could go to the Biden fundraiser for 225. Now, I don't mean $225,000. I mean $225. So it's all terrible. We've really got to change this entire system, limit the duration of campaigns. I outlined my platform on this last week. But even these elite fundraisers, Trump's and Biden's, really can't be compared. And Melania looking this miserable is just sort of like the little cherry on top. We'll follow the fundraising numbers for sure. We have a voicemail number. That number is 219-2-DAVID-P. Here's a caller who wants to know about my soy consumption.
Hey, David, quick question. Just want to get your response. How much soy do you take in on a daily basis? I'll hang up and let you respond. Thank you.
Yeah. You know, as many of you might have heard, soy consumption has become an analogy to being not fully a man. The idea of feminized soy boys on the left, it's a whole world. You know, if you don't spend a lot of time on Reddit or X or YouTube, you might be wondering what the hell is the connection between soy and femininity? And it would be a really good question. But these folks are obsessed with these sorts of things. And as far as my soy consumption, I like edamame. And a lot of restaurants use blended vegetable oils to cook your food, which have some soy. In particular, it's the places like Chili's and Applebee's and places like that. So I don't go to those places. So it's completely conceivable that this caller's soy consumption is significantly superior to mine. But edamame, love edamame, miso. I do a beautiful miso salmon. Miso, of course, from fermented soybeans. But I don't know. I don't really think about soy, and it's not a big part of my diet. But I'm glad to look into it further if you need me to, sir. We have a great bonus show for you today. We will talk about eclipse tourism and conspiracies and traffic chaos. We will talk about Tesla in an act of desperation, offering 30 days of full self-driving to everybody. I got it. I'll tell you my experience with it. And Joe Biden announcing, yes, even more student loan debt relief, even more student loan debt relief. All of those stories on today's bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com. Get any or all three of the children's books at davidpacman.com/book. Hey everybody, welcome to the David Pakman Show. I'm producer Pat Ford filling in for David today as he is traveling, but fear not, he's going to be back with us on Monday. Donald Trump suffered three legal defeats in courts all across the country this week. Let's dive right into it because he is not having a great time when it comes to these criminal trials. Former President Donald Trump encountered significant legal setbacks this week having to do with three out of his four criminal cases. Two were over attempts to dismiss criminal charges outright, and one was over an attempt to delay the trial. Turns out he lost all three motions. Let's start first with the New York hush money trial. Judge Juan Merchan dismissed Trump's motion to delay the New York hush money trial, scheduled to start in just a couple weeks from now, April 15th. Trump's legal team had sought to postpone the trial until the Supreme Court ruled on the claim of presidential immunity that he is using in his federal 2020 election case. That's actually succeeded in delaying that case, at least for now, until the Supreme Court hears this immunity argument. So the idea from Trump's lawyers when it came to this New York case was maybe we can get this one delayed as well. And of course, if you're Trump, you want to delay as much as possible, delay it until at least the 2024 election and beyond. And then with some of these federal cases, at least you have the chance of being able to pardon yourself if you're found guilty. So Trump's lawyers were trying to test their luck, but Juan Merchan stepped in and rejected the motion as untimely, emphasizing that they missed their opportunities to file such a motion to take legal action like this. So once again, this comes down to poor legal work from Donald Trump's defense team. If they had put in this argument earlier, maybe Judge Merchan would have been more amenable to it. Merchan wrote, "This court finds that defendant had myriad opportunities to raise the claim of presidential immunity well before March 7, 2024. After all, defendant had already briefed the same issue in federal court, and he was in possession of and aware that the people intended to offer the relevant evidence at trial that entire time. The circumstances viewed as a whole test this court's credulity." The trial centers, of course, on hush money payments made to adult film actress Stormy Daniels during the 2016 presidential campaign, effectively making it an in-kind campaign contribution that went well beyond the limits. Trump has pleaded not guilty to the charges, and once again, it's slated to start very soon on April 15th. Now let's go to the Georgia election interference case.
Judge Scott McAfee this week denied Trump's attempt to dismiss the Georgia election interference case. Trump and his many co-defendants argued that the indictment infringed on their First Amendment rights, specifically free speech rights. But McAfee clarified that political speech does not shield criminal activity from prosecution, emphasizing intent over truthfulness. Of course, this was always a ridiculous argument to make, because if you use your speech to commit a crime, well, then it's no longer free speech. Just like if you say to your friend, hey, go kill this person for me, that speech is not protected. And yes, you can be prosecuted for doing that, rightfully so. The judge in the case wrote, even core political speech addressing matters of public concern is not impenetrable from prosecution if allegedly used to further criminal activity. Now, the defendants claimed that Donald Trump was just using political speech, like when, for example, he called up Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger and asked him to find the 11,280 votes. That was just political speech, according to them. And so Donald Trump can't be prosecuted for making false political.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCD Pittsburgh.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The sad reality of what's happening in Gaza right now actually eclipses, I would argue, any sort of even comparative humanitarian crisis that we've seen.
As Israel's assault on Gaza stretches into its seventh month, we'll be joined by Arwa Damon. She's just returned from a humanitarian trip to Gaza yesterday. An award-winning journalist, now the founder of Inara, a nonprofit providing medical and mental health care to children. Then Rwanda marks the 30th anniversary of the 1994 genocide. We'll speak with a survivor.
It's not easy for people going through genocide to be that strong, but we're doing our best to make sure that the past never repeats itself.
As up to 1 million Rwandans were killed, the United States, France, and other nations stood by, refusing to stop the slaughter. We'll speak with former Human Rights Watch Executive Director Ken Roth about the role of Western nations in failing to stop the Rwandan genocide and their role in Israel's assault on Gaza, which the UN's top court says is a plausible case of genocide. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Palestinian media say airstrikes hit two homes in Gaza City's Zeitoun neighborhood earlier today, killing and injuring dozens of people. Other attacks were reported in other Gaza City neighborhoods, including Shujaya and Sabra. This comes as negotiations in Egypt continue. Hamas says the latest ceasefire proposal does not meet its demands, but that it's continuing to review the plan, which includes a six-week pause in fighting and the exchange of 40 Israeli hostages for at least 700 Palestinians imprisoned by Israel. While Hamas is demanding Israel end its assault on Gaza, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned on Monday that Israel has set a date to invade Rafah.
Today, I received a report on the talks in Cairo. We are constantly working to achieve our goals. First and foremost, the release of all of our hostages and achieving a complete victory over Hamas. The victory requires entry into Rafah and the elimination of the terrorist battalions there. It will happen. There is a date.
Displaced Palestinians have been returning to Khan Yunis after Israel withdrew from the decimated southern city. One woman, Ayed al-Najjar, said normally she would be preparing for Eid celebrations at this time of year as she took in the ruins of her home.
Our house was good and had everything. I lacked nothing. I lived happily with my husband, and our daughter's children used to live with us too. There's no Eid for me. I have no desire to celebrate or do anything. I'll just sit in front of my house like this. We won't go anywhere, and many of our family members were martyred. They're still uncovering the bodies. Praise God. Who wants to celebrate? Every house has wounded or martyrs.
The UN Security Council will make a formal decision on Palestine's bid for full UN membership this month. Palestine initially submitted its application for UN admission in 2011. This is the Palestinian UN ambassador, Riyad Mansour, speaking Monday.
It was a historic moment then, and now that historic moment has been revived again, and we sincerely hope after 12 years since we changed our status to an observer state that the Security Council will elevate itself to implementing the global consensus on the two-state solution by admitting the state of Palestine.